Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network. David Frum is our guest this hour, senior editor at The Atlantic, former speechwriter for President George W. Bush, and his latest work is the cover story of the March issue of Atlantic Magazine, How to Build an Autocracy. The preconditions are present in the U.S. today. Here's the playbook Donald Trump could use to set the country down a path toward illiberalism. David begins by imagining it's 2021. President Donald Trump is about to be sworn in for his second term. And he, in the article, takes us through the possible first 4 years, the actions that he has taken, his relationship with Congress, the influence of conservative news, particularly Fox News, the president's tweets, his ethical problems. But a Congress so anxious to get legislation that they had dreamed about for decades into law that ethical concerns about the administration perhaps were shrugged off, intelligence agencies finding themselves exposed to retribution for reporting on Russia's aid to his election campaign. Frum has us look at Hungary and other countries, Hungary particularly since 2010, and other countries who have had a slide away from democracy. He ends his lengthy piece by saying, "We are living through the most dangerous challenge to the free government of the United States that anyone alive has encountered. What happens next is up to you and me." I would imagine we're going to get a few phone calls on this hour, and we welcome your participation. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@WPR.org. Facebook is The Kathleen Dunn Show, and we're on Twitter, and that's @KDunnShow. David, hello again. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thanks for inviting me back.
Well, your article blew up on our Facebook page, so I would imagine you've been getting a lot of response to this one.
It has been quite overwhelming. I think this is a moment where a lot of people have a sense of urgency and are looking for actions that they themselves can take. And so I think we spoke to a moment, and I think it is the moment, maybe more than anything that I personally did, that explains the response.
Well, it's a heck of an article as well. Well, let's go to 2021 and imagining President Donald Trump is about to be sworn in for his second term. Give us an idea of what you see in his first 4 years.
Well, I hypothesize that the presidency may turn out to be a reasonably popular one because the American economy is already growing in 2017. If you add on top of that fiscal expansion, big deficits, big tax cuts, big spending, loose lending, and rolling back Dodd-Frank makes that easier, plus immigration restrictions that drive up wages, he could find the economic wind and the wage wind at his back. And that's what decides elections, not scandals. But I want to outline a realistic path. You know, people sometimes suggest some very dramatic scenarios, terrorist attacks after which a president would roll out emergency legislation. And that could happen. But I wanted to approach this article thinking like a burglar approaching a house, assuming nothing too dramatic, no extreme circumstances. How would you change America if that's what you were minded to do? I want it to be realistic and work within what could happen without any heroic events or dangerous events.
You have us, and I'm wondering if there's a direct parallel, you have us look at Hungary of all places, and I believe you were there recently, since 2010, what's happened in that country and whether or not it might be an indication of what may happen here?
Well, Hungary is a very interesting case because Hungary is a European Union member. It's a signatory to the European Convention on Human Rights. It has reasonably free, if not wholly fair, elections. It has an open internet. People are able to come and go. And by the way, although it's a decreasingly free country, there have been no cases of improper arrests, and certainly no one has been killed. But yet, within that context, what you can do is pervert justice, control the bureaucracy, and silence critics.
One of the things that has happened, according to your look at what happens in his first 4 years, is that there is kind of Republicans in Congress have been waiting for this moment for a long period of time. They've got somebody in the White House who maybe will turn against them. He's not quite aligned with a lot of their ideas. But it's interesting to watch what's happened. And you talk about Paul Ryan, a Speaker of the House from Wisconsin, and how the rhetoric about Donald Trump has changed in a very short period of time, that Republicans are at least at this moment kind of overlooking some of the things that he has said?
Well, what normally happens when a new administration comes to office is the president arrives full of ambitious ideas about what he'd like to do. And he realizes he's going to need to get consent from a Congress full of people with a lot of human frailties. And so she looks past those frailties and says, this congressman, you know, maybe not the most ethical person. This one has a bit of a drinking problem. This one is maybe not the best husband and father, but I have to work with them to achieve my agenda. In this situation, it's exactly the opposite. It is Paul Ryan and, to a lesser extent, Leader McConnell in the Senate who burn with big ambitions and big ideas. Donald Trump is not interested in ideas. He's not very interested in the Republican agenda. And he in the Oval Office, is the one with all of the human frailties. And so it is Ryan who must work around him because he needs Trump's signature. This is a special moment for Republicans. We're all fixated on Donald Trump winning. The fact is, the Republicans have won a national popular vote just once in the past seven elections in 2004. And even that was an exceptionally narrow win. They have an agenda that is not popular. And their hold on Congress is not as strong as everybody thinks it is. So they know this is their once-in-a-lifetime, probably never-to-recur opportunity to achieve a lot of things they believe are very, very important. And Donald Trump's permission is the essential condition to get those things done. They are going to go very far to get along with him.
Mm-hmm. And when will they not? When will they counter him?
Well, if he begins to look like a loser, if his popularity sinks and he becomes a threat to them in their careers, or if there is a truly presidency-shattering scandal. But Congress is going to do, as I wrote in the article, Congress can't save him or protect him from these scandals. But there's one thing they can do, and that is do their utmost not to find out about it in the first place.
Hmm. I keep waiting for, I don't know who's doing hard work now on this Russian interference in the election. I assume people are. I don't know if the Senate is or the House is or what's going on with all of that. But you write in the article that he could be saying that there would be retribution against those intelligence agencies that may be looking into all of this. Do you think that's a possibility? And do you know what the status is of those investigations, David?
I do not. I don't think anybody outside the agencies does. There is no congressional investigation. There is no independent investigation, like the 9/11 Commission. That's the thing you probably really need. There may be individual agencies that are continuing to work on this. But, you know, the FBI, which is the agency that is most natural to do it because it's a counterintelligence agency, does have a lot of Trump sympathizers. And the CIA is an agency that is under a lot of pressure. From Donald Trump as a new CIA head. He seems to be a pretty reasonable and distinguished person. But Donald Trump has made it very clear that his support for the CIA depends on the CIA not being so curious. I think there has to be in the works some kind of signal to people at the CIA that too many inquiries in this direction are not good for one's career health.
Mm-hmm. So you think there will be, who knows how long it's going to take, but there will be an investigation?
Well, I think the way we get the investigation is Congress needs, I think it's unrealistic to expect the CIA to investigate the president and the president's election. I think what we need is an independent commission on the 9/11 model, headed by distinguished senior people, one from each party, and with a staff drawn from the intelligence agency that does have subpoena powers, does get very high-level classifications so they can look at the raw intelligence. And because a lot of the material they're going to look at is material they can't share with the public because it would compromise American sources and methods. We got a glimmer of this. The Russians have done this major crackdown within their intelligence services, leading some people to speculate that although the agencies talked about learning about what Putin was doing from technical means, that is machinery, that it looks like they may have had a mole on the inside of Russian intelligence. At least the Russians seem to think they do. Now, who knows whether that's true? I'm not in a position to be well informed about it. But the people investigating this need to know all of those answers, and they have to be people who are so trusted that when they say, we can't tell you how we know this, but this is what we know, the country will believe them.
Mm-hmm. What about the, you mentioned that it would appear, and now we've got this Ivanka Trump story going on and Kellyanne Conway urging everybody to buy her products on TV today, which was a weird thing to say. Americans believing, and I think probably they do believe, that the president and his relatives are making a lot of money off the office of the presidency, Mar-a-Lago, you know, the Secret Service at the Trump Tower. There are all kinds of things going on with businesses coming and Ivanka Trump sitting in on meetings, et cetera. So they're getting a lot wealthier, perhaps, over the next 4 years. Does that make a difference?
Does that make a difference to who? I mean,
to the public. Does the public care about it?
No, scandal politics tend not to work. Look, here's one of the things that I get this argument a lot. People say, I'll make some point. And the person I'm talking to will say, the public doesn't care. I'm not talking to the public. I'm talking to you right now in front of me. Do you care? If it's important to you, the fact that your neighbor doesn't care should not be a good reason. Maybe it's your job then to go make the neighbor care. There's a lot of, we just noticed there's a temple of Baal erected on the Washington Mall. And children are being sacrificed. I don't think the public care. I think they want to get back to jobs.
Right.
If the temple of Baal is of concern to you, make it of concern to your neighbors.
Mm-hmm. And you really believe that's crucial right now. Let's talk about the press for a moment, because it's
real. Here's why I think it's crucial. And the Kellyanne Conway story this morning with the Ivanka Trump year gives us an example. So, look, obviously, this is not the worst atrocity in the history of even this administration, let alone the presidency. Kellyanne Conway thought she was being, I'm sure, amusing, and probably didn't bother even to think about, am I maybe doing something illegal? But she did this. As it happened, it's a microcosm. It starts with the urge to do something crooked, something unethical. Even if you don't know that it's illegal, it's so obviously improper. You start with this effort to do this thing that's improper. You generate a legal problem, and now you have to shut down the inquiry. What is happening, and you need now to neutralize, because there's a White House counsel, and they need to talk to you, and you need to neutralize the White House counsel. And all of that is done very easily. But now imagine that more important things are happening, much more serious forms of self-enrichment, creating much more dangerous legal menaces. Those have to be shut down. I don't think it is unimportant that Donald Trump is one of the weakest White House counsels. By the way, not a place, that's a person. The White House counsel is a job. And it's a job that has been held. The White House counsel is not the president's personal lawyer. He's the lawyer to the White House. The president and the White House counsel do not have an attorney-client privilege, as Richard Nixon discovered to his cost during Watergate. It's the counsel's job, ultimately, to oversee White House ethics, to tell people what can be done and what cannot be done. And that job has been held by some incredibly distinguished people. Lloyd Cutler held the job under Jimmy Carter. There's a law firm named after him. People have gone on to be appellate court judges, have been White House counsels. I believe John Roberts, the present Chief Justice of the Supreme Court, was at one point an assistant White House counsel. It's a distinguished job.
Mm-hmm.
And no disrespect to the former Republican Party lawyer who holds the job today, but he is not someone who's going to have the clout to persuade Donald Trump that he cannot do this or that thing. And I don't know that he's going to have the footing to be able, when the president says, well, I want to do it anyway, say, Mr. President, you just can't, and if you insist, I'll resign.
Mm. You also say in your article, it's essential to recognize that Trump will use his position not only to enrich himself, but he will enrich plenty of other people, too, both powerful and sometimes for public consumption, the relatively powerless.
Right. I'm mindful here of the example of Hugo Chavez in Venezuela. And one of the things I want to stress here is that de-democratization, which is kind of a mouthful, is a global trend. We had a period from, the later 1970s until the early 2000s, when democracy seemed to be on the march, when it was breaking out in all kinds of places that never had it before. Taiwan, South Korea, Chile, Uruguay returned to democracy. And, of course, the fall of the Berlin Wall, the countries of East Central Europe. It was a really hopeful and exciting period. But since 2005, that progress has gone into reverse. Countries that were democracies have in some cases stopped, as in Africa, and countries that remain formal democracies have seen their quality of their governance deteriorate. And that's happened in places like Hungary and in Poland, South Africa and the Philippines as well. It's a global trend, and highly developed countries like the United States and France and others are not immune to it. And Americans don't like to look to other countries for examples of what could happen to them, but it's really important to do so. And to understand, there's more to history than the Nazis. If you keep saying, is this like Hitler, you're going to not understand anything in the world around you. If you think of things that can go wrong as a long train line, there are many, many stops on that train line before you get to Hitler station. And if it's not bad, unless it's Hitler, then most of the things that are bad won't be bad.
Let's talk about the press, let's talk about communication and tweets. You talk in the article about the overwhelming influence of Fox News right now, which I understand surpassed ESPN as the most watched cable network. Sean Hannity's show really very, very strong right now. What is the role? And yet when you watch, I was watching the news. I always watch the news. I go back and forth, you know, CBS and NBC, really. But I've been watching CBS lately, and they're just hammering this president. It's one story after another, one untruth after another after another. And yet if you go to another outlet like Fox, you will hear a completely different point of view. We're all consuming that which tends to align with what it is we believe. Tell me about the influence of outlets like Breitbart and Fox and the American people's consumption of those outlets and how it gets them to discern what a truth may be and not be able to find out what a truth really is.
Well, one of the things that the post-Soviet Russians have really pioneered, Putin's Russia's pioneered, whereas the old communists had an extremely elaborate and sophisticated network of lies, all of them consistent with one another, to construct a coherent ideological view of the world, and that you are a believer, you are within this system, and it gave you all the answers to every question. The insight of Putin's Russia has been, you don't need to do that. You don't need to make people believe everything. You need to make them believe nothing. If they believe it, it's all lies, nothing is true, that's just as good for an authoritarian reader. If you just say, well, you believe what you want to believe, I want to believe what I believe, everybody's crooked, everything's hopeless, they're all terrible. One of the things that is very striking when you watch RT, and when you're looking at the spectrum of pro-Trump media, you have to include RT, which is watched by a lot of American households. RT regularly inserts into its news program things that are just ludicrously unconvincing, mole people beneath the surface of the earth, that kind of thing, crazy stories.
Right.
Why do they do that? Well, they're doing, it's like pro wrestling. They're sort of goofing on you. They're inviting you in on the joke. You know, they're trying to make you cynical, not to make you gullible. And cynicism, I say in the article that somebody who has been deceived by a lie can ultimately be cured by the truth. And then they'll turn on the liar and be angry at him. But somebody who thinks everybody lies never has any grounds to complain when you show that the person he happened to believe for once in his life was a liar too, because after all, by his own light, isn't that just what you expect?
Hmm. The other thing that I worry about is a lack of attention to what's really going on in the world. So the news tends to be, a great deal of it at least, this is what the administration said, this is what's not true about what the administration said, and then we get another tweet and we respond to a tweet instead of finding out exactly what went wrong in Yemen, what the truth is about that situation, what's going on with Russian involvement in the U.S. election. I mean, there are all kinds of stories all over the world, and where are they right now?
Look, one of the things we're all going to have to do if we're going to get through this is we are going to all have to, as individuals, up our game. I so often hear people say, why doesn't the media tell me about this or that? I say, why don't you go find out? I mean, it's all there. The whole idea that there is this thing called the media, of which you are a recipient, that's not the way the world works anymore. Everything you want to know is available to you. Become a discerning consumer. I note that when people say, I'm too busy to follow the news, they never seem to be too busy for the Kardashians.
I haven't seen the Kardashians. There's certain things you got to put out of your mind. There's so much else going on. Couldn't you, though, also say that an indication of people's lack of involvement, of consuming lots of information, was the election of Donald Trump? I mean, aren't we already at a point where we're pretty far down the road that you described?
Yeah. Well, one of the ways to predict support for Donald Trump was to look for people or constituencies that are disaffiliated. Where you found people who said they were Christian but didn't often go to church, where you found places where voter turnout had historically been low, where you find disengaged PTA disengagement, that's where you found Trump voters. The people were immunized whenever you found a highly effective community. And this was true. This is one of the reasons why groups like the Mormons were so resistant to Donald Trump. I mean, the Mormons are probably the most connected, self-connected community in America. I mean, they are joiners. They go, they don't watch church on TV. They go. They, you know, they play with their kids, and they are really intensely involved. And so even though the Mormons in many ways look like people should be Trump voters, sort of middle-income white Americans away from the coast, they were highly resistant. And I think that they showed us, it's like one of these movies where the scientists have to find the cure to the diseases, let the species barrier from the monkeys. And you find these, you know, hey, there's somebody here who's got an immunity. Let's find out, isolate what that immunity is. Involvement, engagement, and participation. That is the immunity to Trumpism.
We're going to welcome phone calls. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org. Our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show. We're on Twitter as well. We'd love to read all of your comments. I hope you'll have a chance to read David's article. It's a long one, but it's really engaging and an important article as well. We have it on our Facebook page. David Frum has been with us many times before. He is senior editor at The Atlantic. He is a former speechwriter for President George W. Bush. And the cover story of the March issue of The Atlantic is his, How to Build an Autocracy. The preconditions are present in the U.S. today. Here's the playbook Donald Trump could use to set the country down a path of illiberalism. So, a couple lines are open. Join us, and we'll be talking to you momentarily here on the Ideas Network. All right, our phone number is 800-486-8655 for your comments for David Frum, and we go to Dean in Elkhart Lake for our first caller. Hi, Dean.
Hi, thanks so much for the show. Just a comment, I think. I used to be a teacher, and last night I had the opportunity to talk to two of my friends who are still teachers, and the moment that Donald Trump, this is, you know, what, 1 o'clock our time, kids are in class, the moment Donald Trump was officially inaugurated, took the oath, and he was finished, applause rang out through the whole school. In fact, some people whose offices are well away from the classrooms heard the applause. If we don't get to the youth, we are especially screwed, excuse me.
This was where, in Elkhart Lake, Dean?
Could I pass on that one?
Yeah, we could say in central Wisconsin.
Pardon?
Somewhere in central Wisconsin. Is that fair?
Sure.
David, have you heard similar stories?
Well, I live in the District of Columbia, so no.
That probably didn't happen then. Right.
There are people who look at Donald Trump, and they see a vindication of something that's important to them. And I want to be, you know, I think that I want to be sympathetic to them. I mean, the terrible thing about Donald Trump is it's not so much that he's a false prophet or that he's offering people things that are deluding them, or even that he's bringing out the worst in people, although those things are all true. He's a scam artist. If you trust him, he betrays you. And the people who he betray most are those children applauding him and their parents.
Let's go to this. This is a pretty dramatic statement you make in your article. We are living through, you write, the most dangerous challenge to the free government of the United States that anyone alive has encountered. That's a pretty dramatic statement, David.
Well, I was counting on most of my readers not to have been alive during the period 1931 to 1936. So that was probably the most dangerous period. I think there are very few people around who lived through those first days of the Great Depression, when it really did look like the American system might come crashing down. But really, since then, and we've been through a lot of crises and a lot of bad moments. The McCarthy era was a bad moment. If you're a black person in the South in the 1950s and 60s, your rights to vote and to serve on juries were denied, or at any rate were questioned. But the difference then and now was, during the McCarthy era, the problem was rogue elements in Congress. But the President of the United States was always a very level-headed person all through those periods, President Truman and then President Eisenhower. The courts were always in session. And in fact, look, most people weren't really touched by it very much. During the Civil Rights era, millions of people, black and those who shared similar views, were you know, had their rights denied, but the courts were in session, and there was a sense of progress and possibility. I mean, through most of the post-war period, people were frustrated who cared about civil rights. Things were going too slowly, but there was never any question about the direction which things were moving. This is different. This is a point where the United States, you really can imagine, I can't easily, and I show in the article how it could be done, the United States being in 2025, a country that still has elections, still has the First Amendment, but feels less free. One more story about this. When I was in Hungary, one of the things I noticed, as I said, it has elections. And yet I noticed when I would go into cafes with people who were in some ways dissidents, they would look around before they talked. Hmm. And that was something I had seen in Hungary and in the Eastern Bloc in the old days, back before the fall of the wall. I hadn't seen it for a quarter century, and it was back.
Let's go next to Jim in Oconomowoc. Hi, Jim.
Hello. I have a couple points and a question I'd like to ask your guest. First point is, I found that since the election, and I voted both ways, I'm a middle-of-the-roader, I decide on the person, not the party, but everybody that I talk to and I ask them a question, something like, was Donald Trump, in fact, sued by the federal government for not renting to African-American with some of his real estate in New York? And I think it's pretty well been proven that he was. I'm not sure how it came out or if there was guilt or innocence or fines. But it's all out there to be said. And what people say back to me is stuff like, Donald Trump is not a racist. I said, I didn't call him a racist. I said that he had a problem of not renting to people of color. Look it up. And they're what you said before, go after the facts. They're out there. They're easy to find. But nobody wants to go after the facts. I'm noticing that almost to a person who, if I talk about Trump with somebody. My second point is, 90 million Americans, if The Nation magazine is right, and I know they tend to be liberal, did not vote. 90 million registered voters did not vote. So if we take the number that did vote, even with Hillary Clinton's 3 million difference or advantage, that means 27% of the population elected this president. And I don't know why 90 million didn't vote, but I'm to the point where I'd like to do in Australia, if it was up to me, and either you get exempt by some doctor, physician, or psychologist saying you don't understand things, or you have to vote or pay some kind of a fine in your taxes. I'm just curious what your guest would think, and I'm a very big fan of Atlantic Magazine.
Thanks, Jim. Thanks for your call. David?
Well, I thank him first for his interest in the magazine. The Australian system, that you pay a very nominal fine in Australia if you don't vote. I think it's 10 Australian dollars, which is something like 7 or 8 American dollars. If I remember this right, don't quote me on that, but I seem to remember that being, it's quite nominal. And the point of it isn't to punish you for not voting, it's to prod you. And there are a lot of Australians who still don't vote. But it's to prod you and to make you think this is actually something you should do. It's a duty. This is not like taking part in, you know, casting your vote on American Idol if that show's still on the air. This is doing something you ought to do, like paying your taxes or serving on a jury when asked to do so. And one of the effects that you do that is you do weaken the relative power in the country of highly ideological people, because they vote anyway. And you get people who are a little less strongly attached to the political system, and that tends to balance the system somewhat. So it's an interesting idea. I would be interested to see a state experiment in it. I think we should try this out in a place and see what happens before making a nationwide rule. But interesting concept.
Mm-hmm.
Donald Trump, I think one of the, and the many, many lawsuits against him for many, many different things, I think it's just obvious, you know, who and what he is. The thing I am most interested in at the moment is, what is he going to do to us? Not who is he, but who are we? If the faults of American society in recent years, the disengagement, the non-participation, if our faults continue to come to the fore, I think he's going to be pretty successful. If we can reconnect with some of the virtues of the recent past and again become a nation of joiners and readers and voters and people who go to town meetings and accept jury duty, I think he's going to fail. And so this is a test of us much more than it is of him.
So what do you make of these massive demonstrations in Washington, the demonstrations at airports around the country, the demonstrations by EPA workers? Is that beginning of a significant resistance that will continue, do you think, David?
Well, my most recent article, which is in the online edition only, not the print magazine, is about these demonstrations. Demonstrations are powerful. They energize people, and they introduce them to like-minded people. But they only make change when they are translated into steady organizational work. Demonstrations can energize, but only meetings bring real change. And the question for all of us is, will we attend the meetings?
Mm-hmm. And the other question that he had concerned whether or not suit was filed against him for discriminatory practices in the houses that he and his dad owned. We also have this, his saying that crime has gone up by this, 48% recently, which is also not true. And yet we have 78% of Donald Trump voters believing that has been the case. It sort of dumbfounds the mind here, but most people would like to know, I would think, what the truth is. How are so many people believing something that is not true, and how can you get people to know what the truth is and find the truth and then believe the truth, which is a good thing?
Yeah. Donald Trump says things that aren't true all the time. I mean, it's really staggering, and it's just recklessly irresponsible. But he does it, and not only does he do it, but he insists that his aides go along with him. I mean, one of the obvious, it's possible that you could have a president, and even a reasonably successful president, who wasn't much of a reader, didn't have much of a head for facts and figures, but had good instincts. You could imagine such a person. So the way you would cope with such a person, you say, you know what, we're going to make sure that you don't have a lot of unscripted contact with the public. We're going to take away that device, and we're going to have people you trust. You appoint them, and these are your people, but they're then going to write out the numbers, and then you don't use a fact and figure unless it's been written down.
Right.
And then we have a staff that does you can compensate for those messes. What is startling about the Trump White House is it's not just that Donald Trump is so indifferent to what is true, but that he's surrounded by people who have become as indifferent as he is. That's really alarming.
Let's go. Thank you very much, Jim, for your good call. Ed in West Dallas.
Good afternoon. I want to make one quick comment about authoritarianism in the United States. The greatest period of authoritarianism in the United States occurred from April 2nd, 1917, until Christmas Day, 1921, during World War I and our involvement and the post years when our greatest political leader in the history of this country, Eugene Victor Debs, was still in jail for giving a speech in Canton, Ohio, and was pardoned by, of all people, Warren Gamaliel Harding, a Republican. I want to talk about this metaphor your guest used about the authoritarian railroad. And one of the stations that needs to be investigated and stopped at is Scott Walker Station, because all of the playbook for Mr. Trump has already been written here in this state.
Would you agree with that, David?
No, I wouldn't. I think Scott Walker will leave office as governor of Ohio. I beg your pardon. That's a major Big Ten error right there. will leave it the office no richer than he entered it, probably somewhat poorer. I don't think Scott Walker uses systematic lying about everything in front of him as a method of government. And I think more importantly, look, this is, okay, here's a test for liberal and Democratic listeners. There is a lot of reasons why you might want to say, Donald Trump, he's just the latest in a long line of Republicans I dislike. He's like George W. Bush. He's like Richard Nixon. He's like all of them. The more you do that, you're not insulting George W. Bush and Richard Nixon when you say that. You're rehabilitating Donald Trump. Because if you think he's just another Republican, well, we've had a lot of Republican presidents, and we've been fine, actually, at the end of it. And what you also tend to find is, 4 or 5 years after they're gone, you yourself wonder, well, what was I so upset about? I didn't know. People, I think that way about George. They didn't like the Iraq War. They didn't like his economic policies. But they look back and say, he was kind of a decent person. Donald Trump is different. And what I would stress to people is, the more you try to link him to whichever other Republican figure you dislike for normal Democratic reasons, not only do you normalize him, but you also cut yourself off from political associates. Because then you're saying, well, what if I like what Scott Walker did? Oh, well, then you should have no trouble with Donald Trump. If you like what Scott Walker did, you should also have a problem with Donald Trump.
Do you know a lot of Republicans who have serious concerns about Donald Trump, and do you imagine that they will be more forthcoming in serious criticism of some of what he's saying and doing?
I do know a lot of them, but I'm distorted here by where I happen to sit. That in the kind of the think tank world, in the world of conservative journalism, the national security area, people who've served past Republican governments and the Department of Defense and Department of State, that's where the opposition to among Republicans is most intense.
Mm-hmm.
It's less intense among elected officials, and it's less intense in the larger conservative media, Fox News and radio, and it's least intense of all in among rank-and-file Republicans in the country. So a lot of the question for the future is which of those influences is going to become most important.
Hmm. Let's go next to Jerry in Onalaska. Hi, Jerry.
Yeah, hello, thank you.
Hi.
I just want to ask us all to think back at the call where somebody mentioned that there was applause in his school and how terrible it was, and we all sort of thought to ourselves, yes, how you know, ignorant those young students must be. They like Trump. And I don't like Trump. But I do think it's a problem with our system, with us, I mean us, that we don't ask, well, why are they clapping? I want to ask that. I want to ask it over and over again. I want to ask it. I want to understand it. It drives me crazy, the pride the liberals seem to have about how smart they are.
You know, well, I think that a lot of attempts have been made to understand that, and people do understand, I think, and it explains the enthusiasm for Bernie Sanders among a lot of Democrats and for Donald Trump, and who both, I think, David, tell me if you think you agree with this or not, really understood that there are a lot of people who have been greatly hurt by manufacturing jobs going away, people who don't have good jobs or maybe don't have any jobs, who really are hurting right now. And it was overlooked by both major parties. And that was what put Donald Trump over the top, I think. And among people, as you said, who normally maybe don't vote, who people in parts of the country that have had low voter turnout, and they saw a champion.
Yeah. I mean, we should never forget that this isn't a country, and the national vote matters too. And the country as a whole did pretty decisively repudiate Donald Trump. I mean, he did come into office on a lucky bounce. And if he had won 150,000 votes more in California and 150,000 votes fewer in the Midwest and coal country, we would be having
right.
a very different kind of discussion.
Mm-hmm.
Why did those children applaud? I assume they applauded because in their households there's a lot of pro-Donald Trump sentiment. And I imagine that probably in most of those households, it was kind of like our team. And that a lot of Donald Trump's strength is that he has convinced many Republicans. The very thing your last caller was saying, which is that he's just like Scott Walker, a lot of Republicans have come around to the idea, yeah, well, he's somewhat different than Scott Walker. Scott Walker doesn't demean women and the disabled. But, yeah, he's more or less the same thing. His strength will depend on how much the Republicans in the country continue to see him as a normal kind of Republican figure. And his weakness will be how much they can be persuaded that he's not. He's something different and dangerous.
Mm-hmm. And you write, though, early on, when we imagine Trump being reelected in 2021, the president who has brought back jobs, voters, you write, seem to have believed him and are grateful. If that happens, if he moves on that, and he's making, I guess, little steps in that direction, if he does a massive infrastructure program, if he can somehow bring back jobs, and tell me how he might be able to do that, he might be able to make some people very happy.
Yeah. Look, if you, in an economy that is growing already, it is not hard to make the economy grow faster. On fiscal expansion, deficits, tax cuts, continue spending, make credit more abundantly available. That's what one of the things will happen if Dodd-Frank is rolled back. I mean, you may make the banking system less stable, but you get more immediate credit. And if you tighten immigration, wages will go up. I mean, it's not rocket science. I was about to say it's not brain surgery, and then I remember Dr. Ben Carson and realized, well, maybe brain surgery isn't brain surgery. But it's not an impossibly difficult thing to do. There are costs to doing these things, and they show up 4 and 5 years later. But in the short run, they do work.
What do you think is going to happen with this immigration ban, David?
My guess is the president's going to prevail in the courts. That the president's authority to do things like this is pretty broad. As some of you will remember, Jimmy Carter did a similar thing in 1979 with Iran. Barack Obama briefly suspended visas from Iraq. Presidents have power to do this. The courts get skeptical if they believe that the motive for doing it is discriminatory, especially religious discrimination. But ironically, the very arbitrariness and irrationality of what the president did immunizes him on the grounds of religious discrimination. As they point out, this is not a ban on people of Muslim faith because the Indonesia's not included, Egypt's not included, Pakistan, from which so many people have committed dangerous offenses in the United States has come, it's not included. So it's a ban on Muslims who come from countries that begin with the letter I but have only two syllables, countries that begin with the letter S and also contain the letter A, plus Pakistan, plus Libya and Yemen. You know, they thought about Indonesia, too many syllables. So I think it doesn't look like religion. It's true what they said. This is a piece of paper they found in the drawer left behind by the Obama administration for a completely different purpose. And they used it as the basis for their ban. And it's arbitrary and kind of irrational and not very effective. But the president is allowed to do, so long as he's acting within his statutory powers, the courts aren't, Justice Scalia used to say, there is a large category of things that are constitutional but stupid.
David Frum is our guest this hour. His cover story, this month's issue of The Atlantic, How to Build an Autocracy. The preconditions are present in the U.S. today. Here's the playbook Donald Trump could use to set the country down a path toward illiberalism. David is senior editor at The Atlantic, and he's a former speechwriter for President George W. Bush. Our number is 800-486-8655. Lines are busy. If you can't get on, go to our Facebook page and write your comments. We'll read them. The Kathleen Dunn Show. This is the Ideas Network. Our number is 800-486-8655. Tom in Burlington, hello.
The Paul Ryan's district, I come from Paul Ryan's district here, and if you look at the boundary line, it's gerrymandered like you wouldn't believe. You might want to take a look at that later. And that's one of the reasons we have these congressmen that are not really responsive to the people. To this other point, Mr. Bowden Gray was the White House counsel during, I think, one of the Bush administrations. The trouble with the schools is journalism was supposed to ask the basic questions, who, why, what, where, when, how, and why. And our journalisms, they all want to be the presenter and not the dig down and get the story. And our the media thing has become so dispersed, it has allowed Mr. Trump to put out his stories, but I don't think he's as scary as a lot of people think he is, because basically he took the Democratic playbook and ran with that thing.
Let's get a response, David.
I'm not sure where to.
Yeah, we can just let a comment stand.
Begin with that.
Yeah. All right. Let's talk more about this part of the article. No society, not even one as rich and fortunate as the U.S. is guaranteed, you write, a successful future. When early Americans wrote, eternal vigilance is the price of liberty, they did not do so to provide bromides for future bumper stickers. They lived in a world in which authoritarian rule was the norm. What kind of eternal vigilance and what form does it take? What do you mean by that? Do we need now?
Well, that phrase... we don't actually quite know who said it. It was often repeated in the 18th century, but it's one of those historical trails. You follow it, and then it's often attributed to Thomas Jefferson, but he doesn't seem ever to have said it. But they had a vision of liberty and republicanism as something that was difficult to maintain. It didn't happen automatically. The United States has been so successful a country for so long that we have a way of thinking we don't need to do anything. They're checks and balances. There are all these constitutional mechanisms. But those are just metaphors. There are no mechanisms. There are no checks and balances. I quote in the article one of the early writers of The Atlantic, a man named James Russell Lowell, who gave a great lecture in the 1880s in which he attacked the idea that the Constitution was a machine that would go of itself. It is a system that is sustained by the actions of people.
Let's go to Bernard in Burlington. Hi.
Hi. Could I make a comment?
Oh, of course, Bernard. Go right ahead.
Okay. Thank you for... my idea is that the process of democracy that allows basically all qualified citizens to vote, that half of them will vote for all they can get for free, basically. And the other half wants to give all they can give to the country and to the world. If General Motors elected their officers like that, instead of like they do in China, with more intelligence, they'd go broke in a week. It's nuts. It's crazy.
Bernard, what do you think about Donald Trump? Are you worried about the next 4 years?
Definitely. He's he hasn't mentioned the rest of the world, the atomic bombs, the different religious factions killing each other. Where's he at? He's just worrying about his Trump Towers.
Yeah, we've heard a lot about that. Is that what is of most concern? I don't know how we discern this, that he's most interested in his business, he's most interested in getting more wealth for himself and his family. Is that a fair assessment of Donald Trump, or is that too harsh? David?
I think that's the core of my assessment of him. I mean, it's worth noting that his Ivanka Trump Nordstrom's tweet came out during exactly the period when his official schedule had him receiving the president's daily intelligence brief.
Oh.
He seems to have listened to about 20 minutes of that brief, gotten bored, and then started tweeting about Ivanka and Nordstrom's.
Mm. Wallace is next in Weyerhaeuser. Hi, Wallace.
Hi, Kathleen. Unbelievable. What a wonderful program. You know, I am heading for 95.
Oh, my. Congratulations.
And my memory serves me well. I lived through the Depression, and I was in high school at the age of 12, and we had a class, you know, social studies, which was dwelling strictly on the rise of the Third Reich. So we followed that very closely.
Mm-hmm.
And it just scares the hell out of me what is happening. The parallel is exactly the same thing.
Thank you, Wallace. We're running short on time. Do you see a parallel, David?
No, I really want to steer people away from this. I think Americans need to learn more history than just the story of the Third Reich, because that really is an unparalleled situation for many reasons. My worst fears for Donald Trump, I don't imagine he's going to turn into a dictator. There aren't going to be elections suspended. There's going to be a corrosion and corruption of legal norms. This is what I fear, and ways of doing things. And that our future looks a lot more like, if my fears are right, more like Hungary, more like Poland, more like South Africa after Mandela than it looks like anything as dramatic as that.
Do you imagine on some front he will be investigated pretty seriously? I guess I'm asking, do you think he's going to make it for the next 4 years?
I resist all of these questions which try to imagine some kind of external event that is going to change things. What's going to change things is our individual actions. And if you shouldn't be looking for somebody, Congress will save us, the courts will save us. It's up to you and me.
To do what?
To be better citizens, to go make sure that the Congress is there. It's not going to happen automatically. If you are a Republican, demand that your Republican legislators take seriously these questions, not only of ethics, but of national security and the Russian role. If you're a Democratic supporter, go elect more Democrats. If you are somebody who works in the public sector, make sure that you're ready to resign rather than obey an improper order, not just an illegal order, but an improper order. If you're not in the public sector, make sure that if you know anyone who ever has to resign for resisting an improper order, make sure they go to the top of the list to help them with a job. Be a better news consumer. Judge your facts. Check things. Read more than one thing.
Mm-hmm.
Always check the source for where a story came from. Did it come from Reuters or the AP or BBC or the Washington Post or New York Times? don't forward things to your friends.
And on that note, we'll have to end and read your article. We put it on our Facebook page. Righto. Thanks, David, ever so much. David Frum, he is senior editor for The Atlantic. His piece is on our Facebook page, The Kathleen Dunn Show, former speechwriter for President George W. Bush. Thanks to Scotty Myers for producing this hour, Colleen Duvall for on-air production, and thanks for your calls.